Good afternoon. I'd like to thank members of the medical care section for giving me the opportunity to talk about some of my research here at this year's annual meeting. And I would like to thank each of you for attending this session, as I know it's late in the conference. Today I'm going to be talking about physicians' perspectives on building a trusting relationship with racially discordant patients. And I have no financial relationships to disclose. In an article published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine in 2000, Pearson and colleagues stated, "Trust is a defining element in any interpersonal relationship, but is particularly central to the patient-physician relationship." Studies have shown that a positive relationship between patients and their physicians has a significant impact on health outcomes. For example, patients who have more trust in their physician are more likely to adhere to medical treatments and medical advice, and in turn, they're more likely to have improved health outcomes. These analyses have shown that from the patient's perspective, an evaluation of the patient's medical problems, understanding the patient's personal life experiences, providing effective treatment, showing empathy, communicating clearly, building a partnership, and showing respect are all factors that patients consider to be important in establishing a trusting relationship with their physician. Unfortunately, most of the work in this area has focused on the patient's perspective. And so we know that both physicians and patients play a key role in this kind of middle bridge of establishing trust in this relationship. And so for this analysis, we focused on trust from the physician's perspective. Our research question for this exploratory analysis is what are the characteristics of physicians who put forth an extra effort to build trusting relationships with patients of a different racial group? And I'd like to state that extra in this question is subjective in nature, and each individual physician interpreted this in their own way. So we recognize that there are a number of factors that are potentially associated with physicians' trust-building behaviors. These include physician demographic characteristics, medical training, the physician's practice environment, as well as the characteristics of their patients. And so for this analysis, we are focusing on the items that are highlighted in yellow, racial background, age, gender of the physician's location of medical training, the year of medical school graduation, and the physician's practice setting, specifically academic versus a non-academic setting. The analysis that I'm going to be presenting today is using data from a larger study called the Physicians Understanding of Human Genetic Variation Study, which I'll refer to as PUG. It's a three-phase mixed method study. In the first phase, we had focus groups that were conducted with 90 general internists in five U.S. metropolitan areas. And the results of the focus groups, led to the development of the health professionals' genetic education needs and exploration survey, as well as the human genetic variation knowledge use and belief scales. In the second phase of the study, which was conducted in 2009, we invited 3,660 general internists to complete a pilot of the HP gene survey, as well as the HGBB scales, of which 364 participated. We're currently ending our national survey. We'll probably be in the field for about three more weeks. And from that, we have a national sample of general internists. And I meant to mention, in the second phase, we used a sample of physicians from the AMA master file. So I'm going to be talking about data collected in phase two for the remainder of the talk. So as I stated, 364 physicians participated, yielding a response rate of about 10%. The physicians were primarily 49 years of age or younger, males, self-reported white non-Hispanics, and I haven't presented ethnicity data because 97% of our sample reported as non-Hispanic. Our physicians also, the majority reported attending a U.S. medical school and practicing in a non-academic setting. And for the purposes of this analysis, a non-academic setting could be a private practice, a community health clinic, a military clinic, or practicing in the VA healthcare system. So one of the challenges that we had in this project is that there are no scales that measure physicians trusting behaviors. There are a few scales that have been developed to measure the patient, trust in the patient-physician relationship from the patient's perspective, but we don't have information about that from the physician's perspective. So for this analysis, we use the question, do you put forth an extra effort to build a trusting relationship with patients of a different race? And it was measured on a 5-point Likert scale with response choices ranging from none of the time to all of the time. And so for this analysis, none of the time and a little of the time are classified as rarely. Some of the time is classified as sometimes, and most of the time and all of the time is classified as frequently. And as this graph shows, the majority of physicians, 50%, reported that they frequently put forth an extra effort to build a trusting relationship with racially discordant patients. So given the design of our study, we identified these key characteristics that we thought were associated with physician trust-building behaviors. In literature conducted with patients, we were able to see that gender, age, and race were all associated with trust in the patient-physician relationship. One of the variables that we didn't see, obviously, in a patient survey was the location of medical school. And so we've included this because race has a different definition within the United States and outside of the United States. Here we rely on the 5 OMB categories for race in the majority of our studies. And in an international context, we don't see race being used in that manner. And we also included years since medical school graduation in this analysis to account for any changes in medical school curriculum or teaching styles over time. So from the bivariate analysis, what we were able to show is that there was a potential relationship between age and physicians' trust-building behaviors and the year since medical school graduation and physicians' trust-building behaviors. And just to highlight, our data suggests that younger physicians were less likely to put forth an extra effort to build trusting relationships with racially discordant patients than older physicians. So given the way that we measure trust in this analysis with our 3 categories of rarely, sometimes, and frequently, we use an ordered logistic regression model to measure the association between physician characteristics and trust-building behaviors. And so we didn't observe any statistically significant associations, but it should be noted that years since medical school graduation was approaching statistical significance. So we believe the findings of our study are quite interesting. A lot of the literature about patient-physician relationships from the patient perspective really do talk about race being a major factor in this relationship. But we think this data didn't necessarily suggest that, but we do think that the results are interesting. But they do have limitations. One is our study is cross-sectional in nature, so we weren't able to observe physicians' behaviors over a period of time. Our response rate was low. We had a 10% response rate. And although physician studies are typically have low response rates, it's still one that we would have hoped to have been slightly higher. We also used a single item to measure trust. And we know that we can't fully explain trust with the one question that we had. And our model didn't explain it only explained a small amount of variance. However, despite the limitations of our study, we still feel that the results of our study provide insight into what's going on. The results of this analysis suggest that general internists do put forth a conscious effort to build trust with racially discordant patients. And though the factors that were associated with trust in the patient population did not pan out in the physician population, we did see that years since medical school graduation was on the border of being significantly associated with trust-building behaviors. The last point I want to make is that we assess trust through a different viewpoint. We looked at trust from the physician's perspective, which hasn't traditionally been done. And physicians may look at trust differently than patients. Physicians may measure trust more qualitatively and less quantitatively. And so it lends itself to the argument that perhaps we need to consider looking at trust from both the patient and physician's perspectives. And so this is our first recommendation for future research, is that studies are conducted that examine patients' and physicians' perspectives on trust simultaneously. Second, we would say that we would want to look at an analysis with a multi-dimensional measure of trust. And we would also like to conduct analyses in the future that would include other factors that may impact a physician's behavior and their trust-building behaviors with their patients. And these things would include physician decision-making styles. So I would like to just acknowledge members of the PUG research team, the principal investigator, Mr. Vince Bonham, our associate investigator, Dr. Cheryl Sellers from Miami University of Ohio, as well as the University of Wisconsin Survey Center. I'd also like to acknowledge the Social and Behavioral Research Branch at the National Human Genome Research Institute. Thank you.
Okay, all of our presenters have been very cooperative in finishing on time, so we're actually a little ahead, and so we'll take questions for individuals in the panel or as a group. Yes?
With respect to the study of crowd out and exposure, as you described the crowd out hypothesis, you're looking for a first visit after quite a while, but as you described what you did, you just were looking for the first visit in the second year without asking how recently there had been previous primary care physician visits before that. Am I missing something? Because I've got to assume you've done it right.
Yeah.
Would you like to use
the
Is everybody here the question?
So I should be more specific about, so the MEPS data doesn't actually ask the respondent about their kind of recency of visits or anything. It's all based on events, outpatient events that occur. So they get the date of that outpatient or prescription drug event, and then, okay, all right, so you know all about MEPS then. So what we've done is look within a 30-day window after that first primary care provider visit and seen if there was some sort of mental health visit or a prescription drug visit event within that 30-day window. Does that make sense?
Let me see. I'm not raising my question correctly.
Okay.
For instance, in your exposure thesis, your thesis is, gee, a lot of visits will lead to getting a mental health visit. If I was understanding correctly, well, I know people are in MAPS for 2 years, and if I'm understanding correctly, you're starting to look for primary care physician visits only at the beginning of the 7 year.
Exactly, yep.
And I'm saying, let's say the person was going to his primary care visit.
I see.
Physician just exaggerated twice a month for the last 6 months of the first year.
Right.
The visit you're picking up is not a first visit. So if happens because there are a lot of new problems rather than happening at every visit.
I see.
I don't see that you're selecting a visit where you particularly see crowd out.
So up until that, so the important point is that up until that point they had never gotten to a mental health care visit. So you're right, there may have been some year one primary care visits where they had unmet need. But, you know, inherently from the way the data set up, we needed to choose some visit. And at that visit, they all do have some unmet need. And so even though it might be their 10th visit where that need was available, it sort of gives us a common denominator for all of the patients to look across racial and ethnic. Okay, well, we can talk more after.
Yes.
This is a question for Dr. Cook as well. And I'm sorry, I may have missed this if you covered it, but I wondered if you thought about looking at, for the patients, males versus females, and seeing if there were an effect related to gender.
Oh, So we adjust for gender in our models, and we didn't stratify by that. But there might be important differences by gender. We didn't investigate that. I'll stay up here. Yeah, so that was the most important part that we needed to adjust for. And so to the extent that there are mental health measures and physical health measures, those were all adjusted for. Except for those physical health measures, and in our case, that was sort of the main question that we had, was should we think of those physical health measures as severity, or should we think of those as representing some other comorbidity, representing comorbidity through kind of system level mechanisms. And so we adjusted for severity of mental health care to the extent that we had mental health variables.
Any more questions? Yes.
Hernandez.
Exactly, and I think that's the reason why there are two definitions that are separated for compliance and adherence. The compliance component really is, are you taking your prescribed medication? And the prescribed medication obviously might have some instructions to it, but they may not necessarily be taking the medication as per instruction. So the new train of thought in pharmacy science now is adherence. And adherence is very carefully worded such that, are you taking your prescribed medications as directed by your physician? We had to let the patient interpret that on their own recollection. Are they taking it as prescribed by their physician? Hence is why a large bias of our survey, and it's really the first of its kind, a large bias is that we had to leave that interpretation to the patient. And the patient may internally feel that, well, yes, I'm taking it twice a day, every day for 7 days, and I'll finish the course, but we have no way of verifying have they really taken their medications twice a day for 7 days until the course of medications is completed. It's really biased by the recollection of the patient. Are they really taking their medications as directed by their physician? It's a little bit of both, and what the challenge in terms of adherence research in terms of health outcomes is, where do we draw the line in terms of grading patient understanding of medical instruction, and then are they really following the instructions? And some of that research is actually quite new. I haven't seen a lot of people in pharmacy science really looking at adherence at those levels, understanding versus actually physically taking the medications as per instruction. Right, right. And there's a study that we've got funded for in terms of phosphate binders. We're using measurements in terms of adherence relative to patient following the instructions. We have, for example, phosphate binders are now being dispensed in plastic containers that have measurable caps. And if the prescription is to be BID twice a day for 30 days, you should expect to see that cap being opened with a margin of error in case they mistakenly open it or not. But you should expect to see, if it's twice a day for 30 days, you should see 60 clicks, plus or minus maybe 10, 15 clicks of them opening and closing that cap. That's relatively a new way of measuring whether they're paying attention to and understanding the directions and physically actually doing the directions as indicated per instruction. But again, that's relatively new in terms of a health education component in our phosphate binder study and in terms of measuring adherence. So it's relatively new because the term adherence in pharmacy science has only been around for, I would say, the last 5, maybe 7 years.
Yes,
I'll repeat the question. The question is, if I understand it, did the pharmacists have any teach back or how to use those? For the phosphate binder study, you mean? At this point, we've designed the educational health education component such that the patients will have health education with a clinical pharmacist, and at the same time be exposed to a video, a 30-minute video. We're trying to narrow it down to maybe a 10-minute video, so at this point, the video is in process. And the follow-up of that is they'll be seeing the same clinical pharmacist throughout the predetermined points of time to track their care. I'm hoping I'm answering your question, but that's how we're tracking whether or not they're actually following the directions, and we're using repeated measures or multiple data point collection in terms of comparing the times at which they're opening the phosphate binder caps between those time points, and if they're consistent or if there's dramatic drops or increases in terms of how many times they're opening these caps at the different time points. Thank you.
Any more questions? Panel presenters, anyone else? Okay, well, thank you very much. Thanks everyone for joining us.